problem is he unleashed the genie that he couldn't control. So the people certainly got rid of the Democrats, and the Republicans took control of the House. But people also then decided they didn't like the establishment Republicans and threw them out, and we got the Tea Party. At the same time, the Republicans themselves were engaged in denigrating the institutions of American government, everything from the Supreme Court on down, and making statements that actually, when it came to Obama, queried his American values, and in fact even queried whether or not he was an American. Combined with a sort of an anti-intellectual movement that perhaps we can credit George W. Bush with starting. And so, it's not surprising that, let me just make one further point. When Mitt Romney lost so badly in 2012, the Republican Party did an analysis. And that said that they had to, if they were going to have any chance of winning the presidency, they had to reach out further, practice inclusion, not exclusion. So they must recognise changing demographics, bringing Hispanics and African Americans into the party, and cease to rely on southern white males and be better about immigration. Clearly that didn't happen. The establishment of the Republican Party were looking for an establishment-type candidate like Jeb Bush to save them, and instead of that, what did they get? They got a candidate who came along whose anger was even more consuming and less constructive, whose disregard for the political norms was even more flamboyant, whose appeals to racial resentment were even more overt, who completely disregarded the facts and had a great fondness for conspiracy theories. In other words, America got trumped, and why should we be surprised? So let's sort of start at the conventions, because why would we want to go back any further than that? The candidates going into the two different party conventions really had two jobs. Clinton really had to unite the party. In particular, she had to get the people who were for Bernie Sanders on her side. She effectively used surrogates to vouch for her as a person and her policies and to make her more likable. The Democratic policy platform showed Sanders' influence, and the Democrats, interestingly, I don't know if any of you watched it, but they were able to wrap themselves in issues that are traditionally seen as Republican, literally wrapping themselves in the flag, issues of patriotism, issues for veterans. Trump, on the other hand, what he needed to do was he needed to stare down the challenges and unite the party, and he needed to show that he could be presidential. But in fact, the convention was all about Trump. And the GOP, you know, the grand old parties, the short term for the Republicans, basically ducked the challenge around dumping him, in part because there was no obvious replacement. And he made no effort to widen his base beyond his white, southern, not particularly well-educated, but not particularly poor males. The only thing I think you could say that really unites the Republicans is their visceral dislike of Hillary Clinton. So the party was left looking weak and looking like a tool of Donald Trump. And this is a really amazing graph, because what it showed is that Trump totally blew the convention. For the first time, I think, since these things have been measured, people were less likely to vote for the candidate after the election than they were before the election. So what happened? Well, Hillary had a very successful convention. 86% of Sanders' supporters ended up voting for Hillary afterwards. Despite all that hoo-ha that we saw, despite all that ranting and raving, they came to their senses and realised that voting for Hillary was better than not voting for Hillary, which would be effectively voting for Trump. And among those who supported a Republican other than Trump in the primaries, 17% of those went to Clinton afterwards, and that's immediately afterwards. So I don't know what the figure is today, but it's more than 17%. So she succeeded in her convention tasks in a way that Trump did not, and this is sort of the beginning of what we hope is the inevitable landslide. So here's some figures of how the conventions changed voting intentions. And what you see is that, not surprisingly perhaps, the big changes were with the independents. The rusted-ons were either going to stay with Trump or stay with Clinton. And independents at 39% is the biggest block of voters in the United States. So independents who supported Clinton before the convention were much more likely to say they did that because they didn't like Trump. After the convention, they were much more likely to say they were supporting Clinton because they really liked Clinton. So obviously, having Michelle Obama and Barack Obama and the lovely Joe Biden and Chelsea Clinton, not to mention Bill, the first bloke, they're all talking about Hillary, the woman, really made a difference in terms of how people feel about her. Her net favourability improved by 9 points after the convention. She's still not popular. She has her net favourability rating is a minus. Depends whose poll you look at as to how minus. About -6, -9. People ask, why is that? And I don't have a really good answer for it, except to say, if you've been in the public eye as long as Hillary Clinton has, everybody knows everything there is to know about you, and you're kind of boring. Whereas someone new who comes along, remember how we felt about Obama when he did come to the public eye in 2004, but by the time, say, 2006 came around, we were all in love with Barack Obama because he was new, he was refreshing, he had a new message. So I think it lies in that case. And it's not that she's without fault either. I'm not saying she's totally blameless. Trump, on the other hand, at the moment has something like a -28 net favourability, which is essentially unchanged since before the convention. And the polls today, I put that slide up just simply to show that you can find a poll that will say whatever you want a poll to say. And so you've got to be really careful about what you do. I mostly use, and in this presentation I've almost exclusively used, the Real Clear Politics average poll. It tends to be very conservative, but it's also very consistent over time. And I think that's what you have to do. But you know, a Fox poll is going to say something totally different than a poll that's run by Pew. It's going to say something totally different than a poll that's run by MSNBC. So just a sort of a warning. So this was current as of Saturday night. And I think there are already new polls out that will make a difference there. So that's fairly consistent. The upshot in the New York Times on Saturday had Clinton ahead by 7 points, and the trends are all in her favour. So who are the people who vote for Clinton? I'm sorry, you've got to turn your head sideways to see this. And it's important to point out that the people who vote for Clinton are, on the whole, less angry and therefore less visible than the people who vote for Trump or say they're going to vote for Trump. But today, they've shown up to vote, and that's really what matters in the long run. Hillary does better than Trump in almost every group except white men without a college education. And their response to Trump may be as much about their economic status as their perception about a woman as president. But one thing that is immediately clear is that that race and ethnicity play an enormous role in determining how people view these candidates. And the other thing you have to remember is the quickly changing demographics of the United States. So in California, for example, more than 50% of the babies being born are brown, or shall I say, not white. And in states like Texas, which is the sort of the bastion, the last bastion of the Republican movement, that's by 2020, that state will be majority-minority demographic. So that the Republicans really are hanging on by their fingernails, and the minority vote, which is becoming the majority vote, is becoming increasingly important. And so Trump, with his racist rhetoric and his "I'm going to build the wall" rhetoric, has really destroyed any chance that the Republicans had in this election. Let's look at that in a little bit more detail. Amongst African Americans, depends which poll you look at, but Trump gets somewhere between 1 and 2% of the black vote. Now, blacks have almost always voted Democrat, but they are now all voting. That makes many southern states that have significant numbers of African Americans look very shaky for Trump, even really red states. So Mississippi, 37% of registered voters in Mississippi are black, 31% of registered voters in Georgia are black, 28% in South Carolina, 26% in Alabama, 22% in North Carolina. What's been going on as a response to that, some of you might have seen the piece I wrote about this on Inside Story, is a real pushback from states, particularly southern states with Republican legislatures, to change voter registration requirements. In particular, they change ID requirements to make it more difficult for minority voters. Minority voters in those southern states are more likely to be poor, they're less likely to have a driver's license, they hardly ever have a passport. And in some cases, for example, they'll accept a license to carry a gun as a voter ID, but they won't accept student IDs. So, for example, in Alabama, every county where blacks make up more than 75% of the registered voters has had their driver's license bureaus closed. So remember, those black people are so poor they probably haven't got, they're reliant on public transport, so going somewhere else to get a voter ID is really problematic. The situation has now been described as the worst since what we call the Jim Crow era, prior to voting rights laws, which were enacted in 1965. Amongst Hispanics, Clinton currently has a 44% advantage over Trump amongst registered Hispanic voters. And the animosity of Hispanics is a development that the Republican Party officials are increasingly concerned about. The "I will build a wall" is directed exactly at them. Because of population growth rates, if Trump wins the same percentage of the Hispanic vote in 2016 that Mitt Romney won in 2012, 27%, he would still have to win 64% of the white vote. So no Republican has done that since Ronald Reagan in 1984. And in a key state like Florida, we'll talk a bit more about Florida, only 13% of Hispanics support Trump, and that 13% are probably almost all Hispanics who come from Cuba, who are much more conservative because of anti-communism. So his key constituency is white working class male voters, and there just aren't so many of these for him to win over. So I mentioned Georgia earlier. Georgia is considered a red state. just 58% of registered voters are white. There's no way he can win Georgia, and indeed the polls show that Clinton is currently winning. But in the end, what you need to do, the way you win in the United States, remember, is not voting first past the post. It's who gets the most number of electoral college votes. And the magic number is 270. Whoever gets to 270 wins the electoral college votes. Each state has a different number of electoral college votes. Some states are already locked in. So we talk about red states and blue states, and we talk about purple states. So the Democrats, the blue states, are generally on the coasts, on the East Coast and the West Coast. States like California, Washington, Maryland, New York. The Republican states, the red states, tend to be in the middle, which is why people like me who spend a lot of time in the United States say nasty things about that flat bit of the middle of the United States. So Alabama, Kansas, Mississippi, Texas. And then you need to look at, and I must say that the light colour blues and the light colour reds reflect the extent to which these states are either Democrat or Republican. So the swing states are the purple states. And some states like Colorado are perennially purple. That's kind of the way their demographics are. And others are purple depending on the year. So let's talk a little bit about the states to watch. So policy wonks like me love this sort of stuff, and oh dear, I'm sorry, that's really quite hard to read. I hate people who put up slides that are hard to read. But perhaps you can see enough to pay attention to the states that are listed as being the states to watch. The numbers in the next column are the number of electoral votes that they have. The next is a series of 8 pollsters say is going to happen, and I'm sorry that I couldn't make the pollsters' names come out at the top. And then the far side are what Real Clear Politics said on Saturday that Clinton was leading by. And what you'll see is that in those states to watch, and the take-home message, that in those states to watch, Clinton is winning in all of them except one, and Trump is ahead by 0.3 of a percentage point. So, you know, what does it mean when Trump is trailing in reliably red states like Georgia, Arizona, Utah, and even Kansas? So the key states for Trump, it looks like he can't pick up Pennsylvania. So he needs to win Ohio, Florida, Iowa, and at least one other big state like Virginia or Colorado. Looks like Virginia and Colorado are gone. So that's why we're saying Florida is really going, it's hard to see how Trump wins without winning Florida. One of the states that's really interesting is Utah. Utah's an interesting state because it has such a large population that are Mormon. And whilst they're very conservative, Mormons are also very socially engaged. So the Mormon population have a very strong distaste for Donald Trump. They just hate everything that he stands for. And they're quite worried that his undermining of Islam could easily translate into his undermining of their own religion. It's interesting to note that Utah hasn't voted for a Democrat for president since LBJ in 1964. And in 1964, do you know why they voted for LBJ? They voted for him because they supported the social rights agenda that he was carrying forward from John F. Kennedy. They thought that was really important. So at the moment, Utah is now on the danger list. Everyone's shocked that Utah's on the danger list, and I guess it makes sense that remember Mitt Romney was from Utah, and he still has a lot of respect there. And Mormons also have a strong presence in Arizona, in Idaho, and in Nevada, so it may play out in those states as well. Also, a man called Evan McMullen, a former Republican CIA official, is now running as an independent Republican. He is on the ballot in Utah. I'm not sure how many other states he's on the ballot in. But he will certainly be taking votes away from Trump in Utah. So the takeout from all of this, without being too wonky about it, is of the 10 closest races in 2012, President Obama won 9 of them. Right now, Donald Trump trails in all 10 of those close races. And in 7 of the 10, he's doing worse than Romney did. So if you're not into polls and you're not into numbers, just look at what do we learn from previous ways that people voted, and we hopefully think that Trump is in trouble. So Hillary Clinton is moving into Utah to campaign. Really, she thinks that's worthwhile doing. In the meantime, Donald Trump, minus strategy and then not taking notice of anyone, is moving into Connecticut to campaign, a state that's as blue can be, that he can't possibly win. But if he wants to waste his time and his money and his effort that way, it suits people like me very well. So this is not the latest poll. There's a new one out this morning from Upshot that shows where that magic 270 electoral votes are and predicts that Clinton is most likely to win 363 votes. So what are the factors that are going to be important around this? As I've said, it seems that Trump is on the decline, and those of us who've worked in politics know that once things are on the decline, it's really hard to get back. So he may have reached a place where recovery is impossible. His enablers have to take a stand, and we're starting to see this happen, and I think it's important that where we first saw this happen was amongst the cohort of national security advisors. They were really the first group to come out. His campaign remains all about Trump. Clinton, on the other hand, has some great surrogates to campaign for them, key among Barack Obama. And it isn't just that Barack and Hillary are good friends, it's that Barack Obama really sees Hillary as being his third term, as cementing his legacy. And particularly around issues like healthcare reform, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So Trump has little attention to detail, and he's only just begun to fundraise. The big donors have shied away from him. What's going to be really interesting is we've got a series of debates coming up, and how Clinton is able to handle Trump's nastiness and his complete lack of any sort of policy. She's the complete policy wonk, and he has nothing, and what he does have, he changes from day to day. Today he actually supports NATO for the first time. I don't know if you noticed that. So she must be able to hit...
Maybe because they follow his advice.
Indeed, yes. She's got to be able to hit back at his nonsense without getting down in the gutter with him. There's an issue about third-party candidates that I hope we'll get to in a little bit. And I suppose you always have to worry about disasters. Things always get changed. If there's some nasty terrorism threat or something like that that happens, then everything I've said to this point in time becomes a moot point. But Clinton has a solid and extensive organisation. She borrowed from Barack Obama, who really knew how to campaign at the grassroots level. It's incredibly well-funded, and it's targeted at getting out the votes where that matters. Here, Trump really hasn't worried about fundraising, and he says he's provided most of the money himself, but you can see what the difference is, both in terms of the total amount raised and the total amount spent. On the other hand, Trump has benefited from a really unreasonable, even unfair amount of free media. Now, of course, getting to be president is important, but in the end, whether or not the president can make things happen really to a major extent depends upon what's going to happen in the US Congress. So it's worthwhile spending just a little bit of time looking at what's going to happen in the Senate and the House races. In the Senate, I think the Republicans are in serious trouble. The Democrats only need to win 4 seats, assuming they get the presidency. They don't get the presidency, they need to win 5 because the Speaker gets a vote. And that gives you 51, that gives you the majority. Now, of course, we know that the way the Republicans have operated with the filibuster in recent years, you actually, 60 is the new 50, or 50 is the new 60, whichever way around you put it, so perhaps they need more than that. But a third of the Senate is up for re-election. It's a rolling election like ours is, only it's done not by halves but by thirds. So of the 34 Senate seats that are up for election, 24 are held by Republicans and 10 are held by Democrats. So regardless of who was running as president, the Republicans have got a tough climb anyway to keep the Senate. So the key races are likely to be in those 7 states that are listed there. It's a bit of a movable feast, depends which policy monk you talk about. Some people would include Arizona, North Carolina, and Colorado. And, without going into detail, I think it looks really likely that the Democrats will take over the Senate. It would be really nice if they got enough votes they could manage the filibuster. Some Republican candidates may manage to squeak by distancing themselves by Trump, but it's really a numbers game. So if the gap between Clinton and Trump is any more than about 8 percentage points, the Republicans who are looking to be re-elected are in real trouble, and that will include people like John McCain. So if we go to the House, it's a much harder get. They need to get 32 seats. Now, what you're already seeing in the primaries is a real backlash against all those Tea Party people that were represented. They came in promising all sorts of things and they haven't been able to deliver. So the voters want to throw them out as well. And the Republicans, of course, all of the House seats are up for re-election, so the Republicans have to defend their seats in fairly moderate states like California, New York and Florida at the same time that Trump is just making life particularly difficult for them. One of the problems that you face in the House is that there are 435 seats up for election, but only a handful of those are, perhaps no more than 30, are actually really competitive. Why is that? Well, incumbency has its advantages. You get your name recognition, makes it easier to fundraise. If you're really good at being a local member, you can pork barrel and send money and advantages to your district. And in particular, again, in Republican states, there's been a lot of what's called gerrymandering, which means that the electoral boundaries have been moved to make it more favourable for Republicans to be elected. So the last numbers I saw had the Democrats winning about 20 seats. I think it might be more like 25. I think it's possible they can get to 32, but it's a lot harder. Probably the last time you would have seen a swing that big would have been in 1964. So one of the questions becomes, when you look at this sort of stuff, is are people going to split their votes? Are people who can't bring themselves to vote for Trump still going to feel comfortable voting for a Republican for the House and the Senate? And split ticket voting in the United States is increasingly rare, actually. But the unfavourability levels at the top perhaps might change things this year. And perhaps because people don't like Trump, and a lot of people don't like Hillary either, for different reasons, that then brings up the issue of third-party candidates. I don't know if you've ever bothered to look to see how many people are actually running for president in the United States. It's really interesting. So there are 14 minor parties who have both a presidential candidate and a vice presidential candidate who are running. There are 8 independent candidates that are on the ballot in at least one state. And there are a huge number of independent candidates, probably, I couldn't count them all, but I think it's about 200, that are not on the ballot, that are looking to get write-in status. No one ever talks about this, and some of these people have been running for decades, literally. But of the two that you probably should, three that you should pay attention to, one is the Libertarian Party candidate, Gary Johnson. He's going to attract Republican voters. The other is the Green Party candidate, Jill Stein, who's a very strange piece of work, particularly for a Green Party candidate, not at all like the Greens in Australia. She might get some of the disenfranchised Bernie Sanders voters. And then you've got this newcomer, Evan McMullen, the anti-Trump Republican. I don't know how he's polling at the moment. Those numbers there are the most recent polling numbers for them. And so the question really becomes, what is the role of... how will these independent candidates play out and how will they affect the vote? Some of us are old enough to remember 1992, Ross Perot won 19% of the vote. 2000, Ralph Nader won a much smaller percentage of the vote, but he was a real spoiler for Al Gore, an election that Al Gore lost anyway. So we'll see. So let's turn to policy. What is it that Americans care about? And it's really interesting in this election because when it comes to policy, you've got Hillary Clinton, as I said, the archetypal policy wonk, and you've got Donald Trump, the only I can fix it man. And it's hard to know what the debates are going to be like. Healthcare ranks fourth. It varies a little bit depending upon who runs the poll and who you're polling, but healthcare is up there with an issue. So let's talk about Obamacare, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which an Obamacare used to be a derogatory term for that piece of legislation that was used by the Republicans. And when I was working at, before Obamacare was enacted, when we were the war room for getting Obamacare enacted, we never called it Obamacare. We were scrupulous about never calling it Obamacare. And then Obama said, well, you know what? I care, so let's call it that. So it's divisive, as you can see. About as many people approve as disapprove, although it's important to note that some of the people who disapprove, disapprove because it didn't go far enough, rather than disapprove because they don't like socialised medicine. But it's fair enough to say that Americans are very confused about healthcare. Medicare is very popular, and 58% of people say that they would favour the idea of replacing Obamacare with a law that provided, where federally funded healthcare would provide insurance for all Americans. They don't like socialised medicine, though. So although Republican opposition is strident, the GOP position is really focused solely on repealing Obamacare. Nothing substantive has ever emerged to replace it. And it's my belief that it's going to be hard, if not impossible, to repeal, simply because people might say, I don't like Obamacare, but they all love all of the benefits that they've got. And as you can see, what people think about Obamacare is governed by their political affiliations. When a policy delivers benefits, though, support for that policy grows in what political science would call a policy feedback loop. You can argue that with Obamacare, that policy feedback loop has been interrupted because of the outrage from the Republicans, but nevertheless, it's still existing. So some of you would have seen that Obama had a paper in JAMA on reporting on Obamacare, and I like to show that picture because the man sitting next to President Obama, the bald guy, is the member of Congress that I worked for. He had a national health insurance bill for every one of the almost 60 years that he was in Congress. He's just stepped down as the longest serving member of the House of Representatives ever. And you can see the smile on his face because he waited 50 years to get not the national health insurance bill he wanted, but a bill that was pretty good. And it is worthwhile reading that JAMA paper from Obama. So 20 million Americans who didn't have health insurance now have health insurance. And most Americans, even those who already had insurance, have gained considerable benefits. So overall, Americans are increasingly likely to view the Affordable Care Act as expanding their families' access to health insurance and health care. But it's not just about providing people with access to health insurance. Are people actually using that health insurance? And the data show that people are now less likely to have medical debt, less likely to postpone care, more likely to have a regular doctor, more likely to get preventive care. And some of that coverage for health insurance has been done by states expanding Medicaid with money from the feds. And you can show that and some of the Republican states have chosen to literally cut off their financial noses to spite Obama by not taking that extra money. So there's a naturally controlled experiment going on between states that have expanded Medicaid and states that have not expanded Medicaid. And Bob Blendon and co. had a paper that came out just a week or so ago that looked at that natural experiment between states that expanded Medicaid and states that haven't. And you can show that in the states that have acted, there are significant increases in outpatient utilization, more preventive care, improved healthcare quality, they're more likely to have their chronic illnesses managed, reductions in emergency department use, and improved self-reported healthcare. So Clinton's health policies, her main task really is to safeguard and to build Obama's legacy, and that's what she has committed to do. And that's why it's really important for the Democrats to win back at least the Senate. Because as with any major piece of legislation, the Affordable Care Act is in serious need of legislative tweaking. You can't pass huge, big pieces of legislation like that without having to come back and refine it again and again. And that has not been done, not even once, in the 6 years since it was passed, because the Republicans just won't cooperate. The other interesting thing, though, is that pushed by Sanders, Clinton has resurrected the idea of enabling people over 55, to buy into Medicare as an alternative to buying insurance through the exchanges. I don't have time to go into it, but the economics of doing that are really sound. In particular, as you can show at the moment, that people There are huge expenses that accrue to Medicare within the first 2 years of people becoming eligible at age 65 because everyone saves up their cataract surgery and their hip operation to have done on Medicare. Trump's health policies, on the other hand, who knows? I mean, he has said he will repeal Obamacare, but he's also said he supports something that looks like even bigger than Obamacare. So, I mean, I've put up a number of things that he said there, and I wouldn't take any of them for granted. And the other, of the other presidential candidates, they go as you would expect, really. I was going to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and now I've decided the Trans-Pacific Partnership is dead on both sides of the Pacific. Clinton has basically come out, pushed by Sanders, has come out very strongly against the TPP, having been sort of weakly against it and then having once supported it as Secretary of State. Trump is strongly opposed to all trade treaties, which of course is in direct opposition to the GOP position. So I suppose he theoretically could change again, and I've really struggled to see how they're going to get the TPP through the current Australian Senate as it stands, so I think it's dead. So after the election, Clinton has understanding... Well, it's a real question about what to do with the first mate. And amongst the leftovers, I noticed that I've actually left the Supreme Court off that list, but she has to deal with those. But I think the real issue is that one under addressing the concerns of disaffected voters. Okay, so Trump loses, he puts his tail between his legs and goes away. I can't quite imagine that. I actually think he's going to throw a wobbly either before or after the election. But those disaffected voters are going to remain. And the reasons for their disaffection, whatever we think about them and their behaviour, are actually pretty valid for many of them. And there are disaffected Sanders voters as well on the left. So whomever wins the presidency, most likely Hillary, is going to have a way of dealing with that. I think most of the way of dealing with that is going to be economic. But there's also going to have to be something about a new civility in the United States. Things are pretty bad. The only thing that saves it, as my American husband continually reminds me, is that the racial discord that exists at the moment is somewhat different because white people, not everybody, but a large proportion of white people care about the racial discord. So I think things are really problematic. And there's a really interesting issue about how Trump will take losing. We can talk later. Now, I'm about to finish up, and I was thinking, could I finish up on a grandiose note? But I might be wrong. So I thought I'd tell you a story about the 1968 election, because probably only Andrew and I are old enough in this room to remember the 1968 election. But it was a really interesting time. It was a terrible year for the US. Yes, it's true, gas was cheap, unemployment was low, real estate values were rising, and so were pay rates, which is kind of different to today. But there was dreadful racial discord. Martin Luther King was assassinated in April. There were riots and arsons. My husband's grandfather's shop in Washington, D.C. was burnt in the riots. There were fears about the spread of communism. The war in Vietnam was escalating. There were strident claims at political events. LBJ withdrew from the presidential race early on because of a poor showing in the New Hampshire primary. That caused Robert Kennedy to enter the race, and he was assassinated in June after the California primary. Two assassinations in 1 year. Then Vice President Hubert Humphrey entered the race, but too late to participate in the primaries. He got all his delegates at the convention from the party apparatus. And there was a huge uproar at the Democrat convention in 1968 in Chicago. Everyone remembers all of the riots. Many young Democrats objected to the nomination of Hubert Humphrey. They wanted to see the anti-establishment, anti-war candidate Eugene McCarthy nominated. Many of the Kennedy delegates wanted to see George McGovern nominated. LBJ didn't even appear at the Democrat convention because the social services couldn't guarantee his safety. Who was the Republican candidate? Richard Nixon. He was challenged in succession by George Romney, Mitt Romney's dad, by Nelson Rockefeller, and by Ronald Reagan. At the convention, Reagan and Rockefeller had planned to unite their forces in a Stop Nixon movement. But the strategy fell apart because they couldn't get their act together, they couldn't agree. In the meanwhile, George Wallace, who was actually a Democrat, was running as a candidate for the pro-segregation American Independent Party. So he was from the South, and he was running against segregation. Because remember, this was the first election after the voting of the voting after the enactment of the Voting Rights Act. So Wallace ran a campaign supporting law and order and racial segregation that strongly appealed to rural white Southerners, blue-collar union workers. He pledged that if the Vietnam War was not winnable within 90 days of taking office, there'd be an immediate withdrawal of US troops. He called foreign aid money that was poured down a rat hole, and he demanded that European and Asian allies pay more for their defence. These stances were overshadowed by Wallace's running mate, retired Air Force General Curtis LeMay, who implied he would use nuclear weapons to win the war. Doesn't this all sound familiar? Nixon won the popular vote by 0.7%, but he won the Electoral College vote by 301 votes to 191 votes. And somehow or other, America managed to survive. So that's it from me. I'm happy to take your questions.
Leslie, thank you very much. We actually do have a roving microphone, so while that finds its first person, I just want to ask, I stepped out for 5 minutes. Did you talk about the Supreme Court very much?
I didn't talk about the Supreme Court except to say that it's an issue that obviously the next president will have to deal with. There is already a vacancy on the Supreme Court, so it's 4-4, pretty much 4 left-wing, 4 right-wing. That's not quite the right word to use about Supreme Court judges. So they really need to, and Hillary has sort of said that she would go with the Obama nominee, but you also have to look at who else is left on the Supreme Court. Much as I love Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she's increasingly frail, and I think whomever is the next president will probably need to replace at least one, if not two more, Supreme Court judges. And Trump obviously makes that a real issue. Who do you want to support the Supreme Court judges? It's a very important controlling factor on the government as a whole.
Hi. Thanks for that. You mentioned right at the top the Republican response to the 2012 kind of autopsy report on what went wrong. In many ways, they did respond to it in bringing up candidates like Jeb Bush, like Marco Rubio, who kind of appealed to, you know, a different type of people, as well as kind of also having a bit of Republican orthodoxy. But then the problem was they were completely rejected by the people who voted in the primaries. So what is the way forward for the Republican Party after having a candidate like Trump? Where do they go from here?
That is the question, isn't it? And I think the candidates that... I understand why you said what you said about the candidates, but they were flawed. I mean, Marco Rubio was not a strong advocate for immigration. He, when, When he was pushed, he couldn't stand firm on his immigration policies. So, and that was a large part of what undermined him. I think the Republican Party is probably going to crash and burn, and need it will need to be rebuilt. Now, in what shape it will be, you may get two parties out of it. You might get a party that looks more like what we used to call the Rockefeller Republicans, the moderate Republicans, the people who are not Democrats, but you know, the party of Lincoln, shall we say, Republicans. And then you're going to get the Freedom Caucus, the Tea Party, the ratbags, the total right-wingers, who are scary, but as I've indicated, their constituency is diminishing all the time. So I don't know. It's just going to be really, really interesting. But I think it's complete crash and burn. Let me just do Mary first, and I'll get to...
What you had up there is, you know, will he last the distance to the 8th of November? What's the possibility, likelihood, process, possible consequences of him not? And would there be another candidate that could, you know, be pulled out of a hat? And, right. and that must, you know, that would right. have to be something I'm sure the other side is thinking about.
Yes. There is no provision for Republicans going now, for Republicans going to Trump and saying, you have to get out of the race. There isn't a mechanism for doing that. If he died or dropped out himself, then there are mechanisms for bringing in someone else. Whom that would be quite problematic. Generally, if elections are in dispute, and this has happened in the past, I can't remember when, someone who's better at American history than me could tell you this, but like when the Electoral College vote is either close or equal, it is then thrown into the House of Representatives. But I think it's the House of Representatives as it currently exists rather than House of Representatives that will be elected. I'm not totally sure about that. So that's problematic. I just think, listen to Trump's rhetoric over the last couple of days, where he's not so stupid that he doesn't know that he's losing. And he's already set up targets. So he's saying, I'm not sure I want to do the debates, at least I'm not sure I want to do them the way the debate committee has set them up. The elections are going to be rigged. The media is against me. And now he's setting up this cadre of electoral supervisors, which are just people who support him, who are, what are they going to do, stand guard with a gun in an electoral office? He doesn't like to lose. So I can actually really see a situation where prior to November 8, he says, everybody's against me, I'm out of here. I mean, I know it's really hard to imagine, but he's just a really weird guy. So, and certainly I think afterwards he will have all sorts of excuses and rationales about why he didn't win, and you know, I imagine he's going to sue a whole lot of people, or at least talk about suing a whole lot of people. So.
Oh, thank you. You mentioned Sanders, but you didn't go reasonably enough a lot into the big support he got, and I wondered. I mean, normally he would not get that sort of level of support, would he? And what do you think that says about the current sort of socioeconomic demographic situation?
It's very interesting. It gives, I mean, Bernie Sanders ran as a Democrat, but he's not a member of the Democrat Party, and he's not very popular amongst Democrats, and he's not a very effective. I remember him in the House when I worked in the House, and then he went to the Senate. He's extremely ineffectual. But somehow or other, everything got moved so far to the right, including Hillary, that it made a space on the left for that to come up. And it is kind of heartening for vaguely pink around the edges socialists like me that there is space for the left-wing debate and for the sorts of things that he was saying in the United States. His ability to actually do anything was zero. So it looks now like about as I said, 85, 87% of the people who supported him, large numbers of millennials, who for the most part seem to support him because they like the free education stuff that he offered, are going to go to Hillary. I certainly hope they don't do the what we saw with some of the left wings on Obamacare, saying it's not good enough, you know, he's not nice enough, so we won't do it at all. But those people are also disinfected and disenfranchised on the left. I don't think those are the people who are going to support Trump.
Two more questions.
Thanks. Thank you, Leslie. That was very interesting and informative. I was interested to see, I think it was on one of your first slides, that you had a little comment on our failure, either the failure of the electorate, the failure of the citizenry. And I think this is really a very important point, and we, you know, the old you get what you deserve may not be quite entirely true, or at least we hope not. But if you look around the world at Western democracies, there are huge problems in terms of the chaos that governments are in. And I just wondered to what extent you feel, that the citizenry is culpable for this, for not providing the feedback and guidance and being more responsible in, you know, thinking about what kind of society we want to live in when we go to vote, and whether or not it's redeemable. And I'd be very interested to know if there's, and if so, how. This could go on for another hour. But I'd also be very interested to know if there's a literature about this. Is this explored and researched in the policy and political literature?
The short answer to the last part of your question is yes. People like the Pew Foundation and Brookings and so on have... Oh, and that reminds me, I actually have a couple of extra slides. Those are the dates you need to worry about. Have done some really interesting analysis around this. I think there are two sides to the culpability. One is that the elected representatives were not listening to the people about what the people wanted. They were doing what they wanted. So it was ideology versus... There's a lot of lessons here for Australia. So it was ideology versus who are you actually representing your constituency? And then I think, I remember when I first went to live in the United States being really impressed at how obsequious almost Americans were to their elected representatives, and that has now all disappeared. And you cannot run down the infrastructure of democracy and expect life to remain the same. You know, you cannot demonize subgroups in the population and expect comity as a whole. So I think I would apportion the blame equally to the population as a whole. Americans feel very disenfranchised from their electoral system, and you often hear Americans say, you say, so are you going to vote? I was in Colorado for the caucuses, and I'm eligible to vote, so I go off to the caucuses, and I said to some people, are you going to the caucuses? And it's like, oh no, I don't think so. It's only one vote. What difference does it make? Well, the world is made up of one vote, one vote, one vote. So they are culpable in the end. And there was there one more?
Yes.
I have a question about this group. It's typically older, evangelical Christian group that they're anti-gay marriage, they're anti-abortion, they're anti-this, anti-that. But then they look at Trump, and Trump's been married 3 times. Like, he's not anything they represent.
Yes.
And so there's a big block of people in the States. I'm really curious of your thoughts of, will these people vote or not? Because they're looking at Hillary and saying, absolutely no way. And then they look at Trump and say, he's nothing I represent. So they're really caught in this quandary. And where are those people going to go?
They probably are going to stay home, or they'll do write-in votes, or they'll vote for the libertarian guy. Trump has tried to get the evangelicals, but he doesn't win. But nevertheless, there are people who... I mean, what do working class Americans think Donald Trump is really going to do for them? But a lot of people think that he will make a difference. So I think it remains to be seen. Vote early and often, I say.
And I think my question about the Supreme Court earlier is I've been noticing that the language coming out of the GOP machine is almost writing off Trump and calling him a wacko, but saying it's not about Trump, it's about the Supreme Court. We can't give over the Supreme Court, or otherwise we lose our constitutional adherent members of the Supreme Court.
Trump being so adherent to the Constitution. Exactly.
So, Lizzie, thank you very much. It's always a delight. Thank you. And I'm sure, Leslie, I want to be respectful of people's time in closing.